Okay, we are up to chapter 16. This topic is really 16 and 17. We won't finish the whole thing today, which means that we'll have to revisit it after Yom Tov, because our next session will be, God willing, October 15th, which is to say the Thursday after Sukkot. I'm not going to do it right after, but the week after. October 15th is our next one. God willing, I'll send out email and let everybody know. But the previous two chapters, you'll recall from our whirlwind summary last week, dealt with the division of the land to Yehuda, and that was the land that basically, if you think of your map of Israel, is the latitude of Yerushalayim, of Jerusalem, and south from there. And now, we shift to talk about the division of the land to Yosef, Joseph. And of course, Joseph has two sons, Menashe and Ephraim. And going back to when Joseph was still alive and his father Yaakov was still alive, we were told that Menashe and Ephraim would be considered like Reuven and Shimon, which has many interpretations, but on a basic level, it means they are going to receive portions in the land, just like the biological children of Yaakov. So Reuven has a plot, and Yehuda has a plot, and Menashe has a plot, and Ephraim has a plot, and so on, all 12 of them. Which, as we'll see, is a little bit odd in this section, because they're going to be identified as Joseph, to a certain extent as Yosef, as though they're both getting one plot together, and that will be an issue when we get to the 17th chapter. But brief outline I gave you on your sheets of where these chapters go. The beginning of it will present the southern boundary of Yosef, which, if you look at the map on the sheet that I gave you, you'll see, if your Hebrew is good and you can read script Hebrew, then you see Menashe at the top in bold letters. Below that it says Nachalat Ephraim, the portion of Ephraim, and below that is Binyamin, which Binyamin is north of Yehuda. So in terms of sort of your vision of the land, you have Menashe, Ephraim, Binyamin, Yehuda. We haven't discussed Binyamin's portion at all yet. So first it's going to give us the southern boundary of these two tribes. Then it will give us the general boundaries of Ephraim. And I must tell you, I spent I don't know how long trying to understand how these verses work. And you'll see why when we read them. Because it's not the way that we try to draw lines, as you'll see. Then, at the beginning of chapter 17, it'll talk about who receives land within Menashe. And when I say who receives land, you'll see what that means, why that's a question. That will then bring us to the borders of Menashe, and then a request from Yosef amalgamated, Menashe and Ephraim, of we need more land. And Yeshua is going to be, you know, faced with responding to that, which is a little bit dicey, not so simple and straightforward, because Yeshua is himself from the tribe of Ephraim. So this presents something of a conflict of interest, if not an actual one, then at least the appearance of one, as his own tribe comes to him and says, hey, we need more land. So we'll have to see how that will play out. So we begin, again, with the start of chapter 16 and the southern border of the two tribes. But in order to address this, we first have to address the question of why Joseph goes second. Why is Joseph after Yehuda? Yeah.
Just something bothering me?
Yeah.
Just Menashe and Ephraim, okay, when they gave out the land, it was according to how many people there were in each tribe, like so that, you know, the amount of people would be relevant. How does that work with the Menashe and Ephraim getting those two portions when it didn't matter anymore because it was their descendants and it was how many people were among their descendants?
Right. So the answer is we'll see. It's a good question, and we will address it. But just in general, in terms of how land was given out, remember that we talked about how the lottery worked and had different points of view, because on the one hand, the Torah says use a lottery, which sounds like it's entirely random. And then on the other hand, it also says give the larger one more and the smaller one less. So, you know, there's some kind of hybrid system going on. One suggestion that we had was that regions are assigned by lottery, but the size actually depends on how many people you have, in which case that would raise the question of one portion, two portions, why does it even matter? So we'll have to see that. But The first question that I want to address is the question of why Joseph goes second. We said Yehuda went first, at least in part because Yehuda is always first. Meaning that we have this midrash about Nachshon ben Aminadab, the prince of Yehuda, entering the sea first, but Yehuda is the one who goes to Joseph in Egypt to save Binyamin. Yehuda is a leader. And so it made sense. Okay, so fine, Yehuda will go first. And in the conquest of the land also, you see when you get to the book of Shoftim, Judges, that Yehuda goes first. But why is Joseph second? What would you suggest?
Because he's the son of Rachel. Yaakov loves Rachel the most.
Right. So one approach could simply be, we got Yehuda out of the way, now let's go with Joseph, because Joseph is beloved. He is the son of Rachel, who was Yaakov's beloved wife, and therefore he has a certain pride of place. Maybe that's why.
I think you mentioned something last year about ensuring that Yosef and his descendants have a status that's not secondary because they've been outside of Canaan, away from the other brothers. They've grown up among Egyptians, and maybe it's something to preserve to show them really they can be part of the leadership.
That's an interesting idea. Right, we did talk about this at some point. I don't remember when it was or in what context, but we did talk about this at some point that it's true. There is this concern that Menashe and Ephraim sort of get labeled as outsiders. Because they're born in Egypt, they're born from Asnath, it's a whole different, potentially different paradigm, and that's in fact possibly one of the motivations that Yaakov has in saying they're going to be like Reuven and Shimon, is to say don't drum them out, don't view them as other, they're with everybody else. So maybe they go second in order to say, see, Yehuda went first and I'm giving to them, that cements their legitimacy. It's certainly a good thought. One answer that's offered, or a couple of answers that are offered really, are based on geography. If you think about the land that they're getting, and we sort of laid it out, where it's Menashe, Ephraim, Binyamin, Yehuda, so Rashi suggests that they really bracket much of the land south and north. Yehuda in the south, and Menashe and Ephraim in the north. So you're sort of doing it the way that, think of doing like a jigsaw puzzle, right? You do the parts that you know, and then you fill in everything else around it, or at any rate, you're doing the major sections first, and then afterwards, everybody else will sort of float around where they go. And if you have in your Tanakh, if you have any sort of a map that shows you the land, you really can see the way they're kind of the anchors. And that could be why. Another approach, which is related to that and based on geography, comes from Don Isaac Abarbanel. He says, Yehuda plays the role of the major protector of the south, because of their size and their strength. And then Yosef is a large contingent, because it is Menashe and Ephraim, and they're going to be the major protectors of the north. So you sort of have lined up now on the eastern side of the Jordan. You have Reuven, Gad, and Menashe protecting against invaders from the east. You have Yehuda protecting against invasion from the south. Ephraim and Menashe protecting against invaders from the north. And now you've set things up, at least minimally, for the protection of the land. So that's another idea. Abarbanel floats an additional idea, which I think is very interesting. I'm not sure. I wonder about how this would have been perceived at the time among the nation. But he floats another interesting idea. Remember that you had 12 spies who went in originally, and they caused the nation, the males between the ages of 20 and 60, these men of military age, to all be consigned to death, except for two of the spies who were good. Right, the two spies were Kalev and Yoshua. Kalev is from Yehuda, and Yoshua is from, as we said just before, Ephraim, from, and therefore from Yosef. So the suggestion is that perhaps you give Kalev and his first, because he's one of the survivors of that generation, and then the other one, Yehoshua, so his tribe will go second, and you give them the portion second. I thought that was an interesting idea. But one really fascinating idea comes through from the Vilna Gaon in source number one, in his Adarat Eliyahu commentary to Tanakh. The Vilna Gaon, Rabbi Eliyahu Kramer, writing at the end of the 18th century, he says, "Bibnei Shehuda ve'Ephraim heim rashei ha'shevatim b'chol makom." He says, Yehuda and Ephraim are the heads of the tribes throughout our history. It's always Yehuda on the one hand, Ephraim on the other, and he gives examples. Bein b'seder hadigalim, He says, in the order of the flags. Remember that the Jews in the wilderness travel under four flags. Each flag consists of three shvatim, three tribes. If you look in Parshat Bamidbar, that's where you have the division. So the first flag is indeed called Degel Machane Yehuda, the camp of Yehuda. Right, that's where the street, you know, Machane Yehuda, that's where it comes from. Degel Machane Yehuda, the flag of the camp of Yehuda. And then the third of the flags, the one that travels right behind the Mishkan, is the flag led by Ephraim. So Yehuda and Ephraim are kind of the leaders of the nation. And then he continues, because that in and of itself, you know, I could have said, well, there are four flags, so there are others who count too. V'chein melachim harishonim hayu, the first kings, right? Who is the first king? As soon as we skip the whole question of whether Yehoshua is a king and whether, you know, Moshe is a king or not. Shaul, right. Shaul is from Ephraim, and David is from Yehuda. V'lachein mehem la'asid b'mhera b'yameinu yiyem Mashiach ben David u'Mashiach ben Yosef ha'goalim v'harashim. And he says, the two messiahs that we're taught about, one is Mashiach ben David, right? The messiah descended from David, which is from Yehuda, and the other one is Mashiach ben Yosef, the one descended from Yosef. If you look in the end of Zechariah, you find the prophecies from which that is drawn. But again, the two leaders. V'lachein nikra klal Yisrael Yehuda ve'Ephraim. The Jews are called consistently in Tanakh either Yehuda, so much so that when there was a debate, there was a vote in the Knesset about what to name the state of Israel. Actually, it would have been pre-Knesset. There would have been a vote among the Zionist Congress as to what to name the new state. There was a sizable contingent that said, name it Yehuda. That was what they wanted. Yisrael obviously won. But Yehuda was the name for the Jews. In fact, that's where the word Jew, right, comes from. Jew from Judah. And then the other one is Ephraim. If you think about the davening on Rosh Hashanah and the pasuk that we quoted, Havein Yakir Li Ephraim, right? Is Ephraim my beloved son? Ephraim is also used as a name for the Jews in various places. So when it came to dividing up the land, they also received first. That's the idea of the Vilna Gaon, and it really makes a lot of sense. And of course, we can add a layer to that, which is that Yehuda is the fourth son of Leah, and Yosef being the firstborn of Rachel, right? And when you consider that, Yehuda may be fourth from Leah, but Reuven had his issue that he was disgraced for, and his father condemned him for, and Shimon and Levi had their problems, which resulted in them not exactly getting a nice blessing from Yaakov. So Yehuda is sort of next in line to be able to get that. So Yehuda represents Leah, and Ephraim slash Yosef really represents Rachel. So you see it there as well. So it makes sense that you're gonna give your portions to Yehuda and the Yosef combination. So that's one note as we start seeing the division. The other question is, as we look at the psukim, let's look at the opening pasuk, the opening sentence. Vayetze hagoral livnei Yosef. The lottery went to the sons of Joseph. Miyarden Yericho, lemei Yericho Mizracha. Remember, as I said, this is the southern boundary. So it's from the Jordan at Yericho to Mei Yericho, the waters of Yericho. I'll come back to them in a second. Mizracha, that's the eastern side. That's the southeastern corner of what we're going to be dividing up. Hamidbar, Ole Miricho, Bahar Beit El, and then it says the Midbar, which is by Yericho. We made reference to it in the war with Ai when we had the blueberries out and we were trying to figure out what was where. I'm never going to forget that one. From Yericho up to the mountain to Beit El, which we'll talk about soon. But the description that's given is Bnei Yosef, the sons of Yosef, leading to the question of, so are they being given as one tribe or are they being given as two tribes? So most commentaries assume that they're being given as two different tribes. The only reason to mention them as Bnei Yosef, sons of Joseph, is because they're receiving side by side, right? One to the north, one to the south. And so it makes sense to lump them together. They are the sons of Yosef. And that's one view. Don Isaac Abarbanel says they have to be given as two tribes. He is of the belief that I mentioned earlier, that the lottery is used just to tell you which region they'll be in, and then the dimensions depend on their size. So Menashe receives here, Ephraim receives here, and we're done. However, Rabbi Levi ben Gershom, Ralbag, disagrees and says they actually received one portion. And he takes the view, I think, that the way the lottery works, this goes back to the next question about why does it matter whether you're one or two. There was a view that explained that the way the lottery worked was the lottery assigned you your portion with the dimensions of the portion. And then when the Torah says, give the one with more, give the one with less, that refers to the individual families. But they're all going to be crammed in and received proportionally within that section. Which is why, at the end of chapter 17, they're going to approach Yehoshua and say, we don't have enough land. There are just too many of us for us to be able to do it. So Ralbag says, in fact, yes, they're being given one portion, although there are other ways to read their complaint. When we get there, we can see that. But yes, they go first. Their southern boundary begins with, in the southeast, Jericho, where the Jews had fought their first war after entering, and works its way west from there, and you can see it on the map that I put on the sheets. You can see how the line goes. And if your Hebrew script is okay, then along the bottom one, you see where it says running kind of top to bottom, Har Beit El, the mountain of Beit El. So it's going from the right, and in the fine blurry print, well, fine and blurry is contradictory. In the blurry print, it says Me Yericho, lower right. And then Yericho, and then it runs north up to Har Beit El, and that's what we're sort of up to in the boundary. Just one note: the difference between Yarden Yericho and Me Yericho. Yarden Yericho is the Jordan at Yericho. Me Yericho is understood to be the springs of Jericho. It's actually a different place, and it's one that we actually mention in davening. If anyone here says that which you will find in a traditional Siddur during Birkat Kohanim, there's a Yehi Ratzon, a prayer in which one says, you know, if I had any dreams, God, make them into good dreams, whatever they are, their impact should be positive, right? So that prayer in part comes from the Talmud. As odd an idea as it is, and we can have a separate discussion about why you're praying for dreams to get better and why are you doing it with the Kohanim there in particular, but in the text that you find, you see a reference to Me Yericho, to the waters of Yericho becoming sweet. If you take a look at source number 2, I brought it to you for you from the Talmud Yerushalmi, exactly. Zeshu roa chalom kashav, a person sees a harsh dream. Sarich lomar, you should say, Yehi ratzon lefanecha, dot, dot, dot. And if it is a negative dream, he continues to say within this prayer, just as you took the bitter waters when the Jews were in the wilderness and made them sweet, and the waters of Yericho via Elisha. It's talking about when Naaman, the non-Jewish general, came to Elisha. And Elisha, he had some kind of skin ailment. What it is not exactly clear. It's Sarat, whatever it was. And Elisha tells him that he should go dip in the waters of Yericho. And, you know, we have great waters at home, great rivers at home. Why should Israel be any better? And he says, dip. And he dips. And sure enough, he gets better. And that's a sign of sign of many things. I'll leave that out. The point is that the reference is to the waters of Yericho. That's what this is. This marker here is some kind of a spring by the city of Jericho. Clear? Okay. So that's part of this southern border, and from there the border continues west. So we're now at Pasuk Bet, sentence 2. V'yatzami Beit El Luza. It goes from Beit El to Luz. And then it goes to the Gevul Ha'arki, the boundary of... Now here, it's actually unclear how to translate this. I'm curious what your translations have for those who have a translation here. How does it translate Gevul Ha'arki in sentence, towards the end of sentence 2?
The border of the Arkite.
The border of the Arkite? Is that what everyone has?
Arki.
Yeah, it's Arki's border. Right, is what it is, and that's the way that most take it. If you remember your life of King David, so remember that at one point David HaMelech, King David's son, Avshalom, rebels against him and is successful and is given advice by Achitophel, whose word is considered, as Tanakh says, like the word of God. You always listen to Achitophel, no matter what he tells you to do. And Achitophel says to him, you better finish off your father now. If you don't finish him off, you're going to be in trouble. And that's what he's going to do. And then Hushai, who is an ally of David, goes to him and says, you know what? That's not the best strategy. Your father's a dangerous man. First, you should rally troops from everywhere, and then you'll make a clean sweep of the country with your troops, and you'll knock him out. Otherwise, he'll get a partial victory. The morale will shift. You're better off gathering everybody first. And the result is that it gives David time to regroup. And ultimately, Avshalom is defeated. So Hushai is Hushai Ha'arki. So some suggest that's what this is. This is Gebul HaArki. He's from that area. The Mikra suggests that origin. The other suggestion that I've seen from the Malbim commentary is that the Arki is actually, it doesn't mean that. It comes from the Hebrew word Aroch, which means long. And it means to say it's the east-west border, because it's going to say that it goes along the Gebul HaArki, which is not marked on here, to Atarot. So he says there are multiple places called Atarot, and they need to tell you here it's Atarot on the east-west boundary, not Atarot elsewhere. The Atarot reference here is likely what's called here Atarot Adar, on the downward southern slope from Har Beit El. As you work your way down, you can just see it says Atarot Adar. So that Mikra thinks Atarot Adar and Atarot are the same place. Oh, it does say Arki there.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, no, I missed that.
Yeah.
Okay. However you slice it, you're continuing to head west right now in the boundary. The place Atarot is a generic name. You find, just like we've seen before, the name Mitzpah just means a lookout. It's some kind of an outcropping, and you'll see many places with mitzvah, sometimes with another word with it. Mitzvah Rimon is a famous one, but there are others. So too, Atarot is a generic name. What's an Atara in Hebrew?
Crown.
A crown. So that Mikra suggests, and it makes sense, that when you have a city at the top of a mountain, the wall protecting the city, going around the top of the mountain looks like a crown. And so that's how it gets the name Atarot. It's the crown at the top of the mountain. The only other note I want to make on this sentence is that it says it goes out from Beit El to Luz. So in Bereshit Perek Chaf Chet, chapter 28, we are told that Beit El and Luz are the same place. That Beit El was originally named Luz, and then it became Beit El. So how do you go from Beit El to Luz? So there are all sorts of articles that I've seen on this, trying to figure this one out. Simply, Abarbanel says this is a different Beit El. Dat Mikra, the edition that I have here, says that there were two towns, one Beit El, one Luz, that were founded in the same general area, but Luz ceased to exist before Beit El came into primacy. So the area was known first as Luz, and then as Beit El. They're actually on two spots within the area. And that would fit this as well. I wouldn't get so hung up on it, but I know some people are more into geography, some people are less. I'm trying to satisfy both. But our boundary is extending westward. And then Pasuk Gimel, sentence 3, V'arad yama el gavul hayafleti. It descends westward, going towards the Mediterranean, to the boundary of the Yafleti. Yafleti is some kind of sub-tribe of Canaanites who live there. There's a member of the tribe of Asher who's known as Yaflet. Elsewhere in Tanakh, the Amikra says, don't be surprised, Semites have common names. But the Yafleti are somewhere here. If they're Semites, they're not Canaanites. Figure that out. But nonetheless, it goes towards the boundary of this population known as the Yafleti, ad gevul Beit Choron Tachton, to the boundary of Beit Choron Tachton, lower Beit Choron. There's also upper Beit Choron. We're not there yet. Although you can see both of them marked along the boundary. One of them, as it curves south from Har Beit El, almost at the bottom of it, it says Beit Horon Elyon, and then further along as you go west, right after the word Ha'arki, you see Beit Horon Tachton. That's lower Beit Horon. You see it?
Mm-hmm.
Lower Beit Horon is technically north of upper Beit Horon, but don't get thrown off by that. Lower and upper have to do with the topography, not with north and south. And then from there, Viad Gazer, it goes to the well-known city in Tanakh called Gezer. Gezer comes up a lot. Gezer doesn't just mean carrot. It also is an important city. Many digs there temporarily. And then from there, it goes west out to the Mediterranean. So that is our southern border of Ephraim and of Yosef as a whole. Understood?
But what about the rest of us here?
So it just extends. Like it's taken as a natural enough, a natural enough boundary that they don't need to give you, or maybe there were no cities in that spot, although I would think there would have been. Whether they're Philistine, well, they're north of the Philistines, but still, it doesn't give us names of cities there. Then is where we get into trouble in terms of figuring out how these sentences go. And I'm not going to torture you with all the details of why this is challenging. That's why I brought you the picture, in order to save us from that. But you'll see as we read it, it doesn't read straight, but we'll see. It's going to give us the boundaries of Ephraim now. So we begin in Pasuk Daleth, sentence 4, with something that seems innocuous. Vayinchalu v'nei Yosef, the sons of Yosef received their nachalot, their shares. Menashe v'Ephraim. Menashe and Ephraim. Good? Straightforward? Simple? Vayihi gevul b'nei Ephraim l'mishpachosam, sentence 5. And the boundary of Ephraim for their families. And then it begins with the boundary. What's the problem? Not necessarily. The only one by he. Oh, the two. There's another one after it by he.
What were they talking about beforehand?
Well, before they were giving you the southern border of Yosef, Menashe, and Ephraim.
Altogether. Now they're not saying Menashe.
Right. Menashe is going to come next.
Menashe is the first son. Ephraim's son.
Right. The Diane said it. It says the sons of Yosef get their shares, Menashe and Ephraim, and then it starts on Ephraim.
Well, that's the same idea. But it's also because if he started with the southern border, they're working up. Good. So these are both, I think, good explanations.
The Dat Mikra offers three different explanations for this. Their first explanation is that's simply what we say in Aramaic. The Talmud has this line, Pasach b'mayta salik minei, which means a discussion begins with whatever we were discussing previously, whatever we had just left. So it said, this is the land given to Menashe and Ephraim. Ephraim got, it's just whatever we just mentioned. As we mentioned Ephraim, so now we continue with Ephraim. Second answer is that in general, we're seeing in the boundaries that the Torah goes from the south to the north. When we talked about the eastern side of the Yarden, first the Torah talked about Reuven getting the land in the south, then Gad further north, and then Menashe at the top. It works its way from south to north. So that's another possible explanation. Remember that if you're facing east, which we usually do, then the north is on your right, so you're going from left to right. And remembering that we have a tradition going back biblically that there's higher Kedusha, there's higher sanctity on the right, Mimi no, Eish dat lamo. Sorry, am I wrong?
Facing east.
No, the north is on your left, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, so I'm wrong. Okay, never mind. Scratch that. It was a nice idea while it lasted. But in any case, it is true that the land generally starts from the south and works its way north. But yeah, thank you for reorienting me. But then another suggestion that he offers, as Alina just mentioned, is also that it's like Yaakov. Yaakov switches when he gives the bracha, when he gives the blessing, he switches his hands to put Ephraim ahead of Menashe. So too here, he names them Menashe and then Ephraim, because Menashe is the firstborn, but then he gives the portion to Ephraim before giving it to Menashe, as they were switched for their blessings. Okay. More about the switch and the blessings if you look in Bereishit chapters 48 to 50. Okay. So here, we're in the middle of sentence 5. And I want to orient you on a map in order for you to be able to follow this. What he's now doing is starting this sentence that talks about their boundary with the southern boundary of Ephraim, consistent with the idea that we go south to north. But he's starting in the middle. He's going to start from Atrot Adar, which is right in the middle. Remember I said it could be the same as Atarot? So Atrot Adar is, if you look at the word Ha'arki, that's above the southern boundary, written on a slant, by the beginning of the word, you see Atrot Adar. Above it is Ketef Luza. So he starts from there. Vayhi Gvul Nachlasam Mizracha. The boundary of their portion east, right? He says east. What he means is not east. What he means is the southern boundary, but he's going to be providing us with an element of the eastern part of the central section of the southern boundary. Atrot Adar Ad Beit Charon Elyon, to Beit Charon Elyon, which is actually west of there. You start to see why in the world this took me forever to figure out. Because the only description he gave us is that it's east, but it's actually the southern border, and he's going from east to west, in the middle of the border. And none of the maps make this any more intelligible. It's not the way we usually do things. And then, the next thing to happen, V'yatsaha Gvul Hayama, the boundary towards the sea goes out, and he's actually now talking about the northern border. He's done with the southern border. He just added a little detail about the southern border. Just, you should know, here's a little detail about the southern border of Ephraim. I've already given you the general border, he says, before that. And now he's going to shift gears without telling you that he's going to the northern border, and he's starting not from the edge, but from a place called Michmitat, which, if you look at your map, if you look at the map and start from the northeast, by the Yarden, by the Jordan, and work your way west, and you see how it goes north? At the peak, the northern peak of that boundary, below the line, it says HaMichmetat. That's a region that he's talking about here. Yeah, I blew it up as large as I could, but the larger you blow it up, the fuzzier some of the words get. Yeah, and then it doesn't fit on one page. But I gave you the link where you can read the article that this comes from. And basically, the way that Dr. Elit Sur, who did this map, the way that he does this is he just goes through a whole bunch of archaeological digs trying to say, well, this place is here, this place is here, now let's connect the dots. That's more or less the way he does
it. How do you extrapolate the part closer to your den? How does he know?
So that's a problem, actually. We'll see. Yeah. Based on the question of where that Atarot is.
Yeah.
So, V'yatsaha Gavul Hayama, so the boundary goes out westward, HaMichmetat Mitzafon, Michmetat from the north. And what he means by that is unclear. There's a debate as to whether Michmetat is within this boundary, so it's going north of Michmetat, or Michmetat is north of the boundary line. You can see that Dr. Elitzur has the boundary being north of Michmetat. V'nasav ha'gevul mizracha ta'anat Shiloh. The boundary goes east from there, even though it just said west. It goes east from there to a place called Ta'anat Shiloh. V'avaro to mimizrach Yanocha. And it passes east of Yanocha. So we are presumably still heading east at this point. V'yarad miyanocha Atarot, and then it descends from there to Atarot, and you can see on your map it's not clear where Atarot is. There are two different views. V'na'arata, as well as a place called Na'arat, or Na'aran, as Da Mikra notes. We don't know exactly where that is. Ufaga b'Yericho, it will then get to Yericho, Jericho, v'yatsa ha'yardain, and the Jordan. Now Jericho is south of there. So I'm not clear exactly how they got to Yericho, how they got to Jericho, unless what they're saying is that it really comes down and goes almost to a point, but that's not what he's doing on this map. But that's the eastern half of the northern border, from Michmetat working its way east to the Jordan. Then, Pasuk Chet, sentence 8, he goes west, starting from the middle again. Mi Tapuach, from the land of Tapuach. We think of Tapuach as apple, right? Especially this time of year. But Tapuach doesn't have to mean apple. apple, it generally means something that's round and somewhat inflated. So that actually, that's how you end up with things like tapuach adama, tapuach zahav, right, for other fruit of a of that sort of a shape. So he says, mitapuach yelecha gavul yama nachal kana. From tapuach, the northern boundary will go west to Nachal Kana, which he notes on the map, Nachal Kana being some kind of a stream. Vayusotz osav hayama, then it extends westward. Zos Nachalas Matei Bnei Ephraim Lemishpachosam, that is the portion of the tribe of Ephraim for their families. That's how he did it. And again, you can thank me. This was chaos. The Ha'arim Hamivdalos Livnei Ephraim, Besoch Nachlas Bnei Menashe, we're in sentence 9. The cities Hamivdalot, what is a Havdalah?
Separation.
A separation. It means the border. So the cities that are on the border go to Ephraim, Besoch Nachlas Bnei Menashe, even if they actually are on the Menashe side of the border, they still go to Ephraim. Kol ha'arim v'chatzreihem, the cities as well as their villages, the chatzerot, the villages that are around them, they all go to Ephraim. And the reason for that, the commentators explain, is simply because Ephraim's portion is much smaller than Menashe's portion. So to compensate for that, the border cities go to them. Now, why don't you just move your border then? Yeah. But that's the... Yeah, that's true. We had enough trouble drawing it the first time. The last sentence in the chapter, Velo horishu as haknani hayoshev begazer. They did not conquer the Knani who dwell in Gazer. That's Gezer, that on the southern border, the western end of the southern border. Vayeshev haknani bekerb Ephraim adayom azeh. The Knanites continue to live in Ephraim until this very day. Vayilamas oved, and they were made to work and they pay tribute. Now, this is yet another appearance of that phrase we've seen repeatedly in the book, till this very day. But unlike some of the other ones, we can actually define this very day. I gave you a reference on your sheet, source number 4, to Malachim Aleph, Kings 1, chapter 9, sentence 16. Those of you who have a full Tanakh, take a look please and tell me what you see. Kings 1:9-16. Could be. I don't remember the opening sentence. Yeah, that's the one. That's
right.
And what did he do with it? Right. When Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, marries the daughter of Paro, right, one of his various wives. So Paro, as a show of goodwill, as a gift for his daughter, conquers this region with Gezer in it, does away with the Canaanites, and gives the city as a present to the newly married couple. Right? Some people give. What? Well, now that he conquered it, it is. Right? Some people give, like, I don't know, linens, and some people give, money or whatever, and he gave a city. It's the Egyptian way. So, that's the... But the point is that when the text says, Ad Hayom Hazeh, that the Canaanites are still there until this very day, clearly it doesn't mean now, because they're not. It must be referring to the time when Yehoshua is written down. Whatever it is that Yehoshua is canonized, at that point Canaanites are still there. But it doesn't mean that they're there at this at this later date or by the time of the Great Assembly when they canonize Tanakh. The Canaanites are long gone from Gezer at that stage. Okay. So what we've seen in this chapter, just to sum up chapter 16, is we talked about why Yosef goes second and suggested ideas either based on the geography that it made sense or based on Yehoshua and Kalev, the two good spies who have survived all this time, or the classic sort of interplay between Yehuda and Ephraim as the two leaders, so we'll have them go first. There was another idea.
progression of the land.
The progression of
dispersing, right? Oh, that was Joe.
No,
okay.
Yeah,
okay.
No, there was another. Okay. The it's on the recording. We discussed whether Yosef is one tribe or two tribes, and generally speaking, it's assumed they're getting as two tribes, even though it says sons of Joseph. The other idea was that it's in order to cement their status as Jews. That was Sima's idea. You could have told me. Then we started talking about the boundary itself and how the boundary runs from Me'iricho, Yarden Yericho, to Me'iricho, those waters of Yericho that were improved, and then improved via Elisha for Naaman. And we saw the southern boundary. We saw that it then gives us the boundary of Ephraim before giving us the portion of Menasha, which could be part of this south to north progression. It also could be like Yaakov flipping, putting Ephraim before Menasha. And we saw the way the southern boundary runs, and then the added boundary of Ephraim, they add a little bit on the southern boundary, sort of the middle of it, and then they give us the northern boundary, first working from the middle east, and then working from the middle west. And that's basically what we did in this chapter, concluding with Gezer being settled by the Canaanites, Ephraim didn't conquer it, and so forth. There's actually a very interesting article that I saw that I didn't spend the time on to really look at it closely, but an interesting article by someone who wanted to argue that the progression of which tribe receives in which order has to do with which tribes conquered the land and which tribes did not conquer it. That it's sort of, you start with a high of Yehuda, because Yehuda is considered to be one of the greater ones in this regard, and then you go down with Ephraim who didn't. And then you're going to go up with Menasha, who does, and then you're going to go down with what comes next. It was an interesting idea, but we need to see more tribes before we can actually discern that kind of a pattern.
What do you mean? Didn't conquer? Like they weren't fighting?
Yeah, they leave it. They don't attack the Canaanites in their midst. They settle where they settle, working around the Canaanites.
But yeah, make God upset. Here he is giving them the land, and they're like, "Meh, I'm not going to conquer it. Just leave it."
What do you think?
I don't know, because that was
yes.
The original...
Right, the original purpose, remember that when we had our ethnic cleansing discussion, right, we made the point that as is presented in the Chumash, the Jews aren't receiving the land because they're wonderful, the Jews are receiving the land as God's tool in order to get rid of the immoral, abusive, and so on Canaanites. So, if that's true, then yes, they hadn't done what God wanted them to do. And we already saw, actually, at the end of last year, we saw criticism of Yehoshua for not engaging in complete conquest of the land. And yes, they will be criticized for it as well. Yeah. Okay, that brings us to chapter 17. And that's good for those especially who aren't, in it for the geography, because that means you're one chapter closer to the post-geography sections.
It's fun.
Look, for some people it is, and for some people it's not. It's Torah, and therefore we're going to do it, but not fun for everybody. Verses 1 to 6 in chapter 17 discuss the question of who exactly receives land within Menasha. The chapter begins, "Vayhi ha-goral le-matei Menasha," the lottery was for the tribe of Menasha, "Ki hu b'chor Yosef," for he is the firstborn of Yosef. The word "ki" is an odd word there. For he is the firstborn of Yosef, because, that would have been why he should be first. So some say that "ki" actually here means even though he is the firstborn of Yosef. "Limachir b'chor Menashe," for Machir, who is the firstborn of Menashe, "avi ha-gilad," the father of the Gilad. Now, in truth, Machir has a son named Gilad. But what it's referring to here is Machir being the leader of, the one who controls, the region called Gilad. If you remember from when we did the eastern side of the Yarden, the area that Menashe got was the northern part east of the Jordan, and that area is the area called Gilad. So, Avi HaGilad, father of Gilad, means controller of the Gilad region. Sorry?
That's
The Giladi, exactly. He is a resident of Gilad. Ki hu haya ish milchama, because he, Machir, was a man of war, he was a warrior. Vahilom ha Gilad vaha Bashan, and he received the area called Gilad as well as the Bashan on the eastern side of the Yarden. So this is a good place to have a conversation about the splitting of Menashe. We asked about this, it was actually a Sima's question. Oh well. Why does Menashe, number one, get split? And number two, why does he get such a large area of land? If you have a map that shows you the east and west side of the Yarden, you realize Menashe gets more than anybody. Like, what is it about Menashe that they just get...
Didn't you say it's like, you know, quality as opposed to quantity? Maybe his land wasn't livable or like hilly.
Right. So one possibility is that it's quantity compensating for quality. But the question of why they're split... is the more challenging question, especially because if you were to look back at Bamidbar Perek Lamed Bet, chapter 32 in Bamidbar, the very first verse in Numbers chapter 32 says, "Umikne Rav Haya Levnei Reuven VeLevnei Gad Atzum Meod." It says Reuven and Gad had a lot of cattle. VaYiru Es Eretz Yazer Ves Eretz Gilad. They looked at the land of Yazer. They looked at the land of Gilad. VeInei Makom Mekom Mikneh, and it was a place of cattle. And they approached Moshe and made their demand and so forth and got what they got. But Menashe wasn't there. Reuven and Gad are the ones who asked for the eastern side of the Yarden, the eastern side of the Jordan. And it is only when you get to, in that chapter, sentence 39. Is it 39 or 29? That it mentions Menashe. In Perek Lamed Bet, chapter 32.
It's
39. So what does it say there? Oh, you know what I wanted? I'm sorry, not 39. Sorry. Well, two things. First of all, on your sheet, correct 29 to 39, because that was what I meant to write. But the other is that it's sentence 20, I'm sorry, it's sentence 33 that Menashe ends up in.
Yeah.
You see that?
Yeah.
Right. Oh, I don't. That's in my notes.
Oh,
the question is that. The question is why am I having difficulty if it's in my notes? But sentence 33 is where we find out that Menashe is getting land on the eastern side of the Yarden.
I feel like we spoke about this last year, didn't we? And we said we're going to find out there's a reason.
And that's where we are. We have arrived.
Like it threw it in here. Like,
they just added them.
They just get thrown in. So Aura remembers. Aura remembers a suggestion that I gave last year, which I've seen suggested, that it's meant to unify those who are on the eastern and western side of the Yarden, because when they're different tribes, it's possible for them to look at each other as really being more distant relatives. And in fact, we're going to see that happen towards the end of the book. But if you split one tribe, and everybody knows the people on the east call themselves Menashe, the people on the west call themselves Menashe, it will help to cement them and help to bring people together. However, that doesn't answer the question of why Menashe. Right? It could have been anybody who would have been split that way. Why did you choose Menashe as the one who would be the bridge? So I want to suggest a few answers at this point. One answer is brought in Rabbi David Kimchi the Radak. He notes what I brought you in source number 5, that should have said 39, which, looking back at that verse, it says that the children of Machir conquered that region. You want to know why they end up on that side of the Yarden? Because they were the ones who conquered it. Simple and straightforward. If you look at your sheet, source number 6, that's where I gave you the quote from Radak. He says, Lefisha Hayahu, meaning Menashe, Bechor Yosef. He says, Menashe is the firstborn of Joseph. Umachir Haya Bechoro. And Machir is the firstborn of Menashe. V'haya ish milchama, and he was a warrior. Zeh garam lo sheba lo hanach la be'eretz ha-Gilad. And that, this might of his, caused him to get the portion in Gilad. Ki b'nei Gad u'b'nei Reuven shalu asa ha'aretz, because Reuven and Gad asked for that land, v'b'nei shayel lahem mikneh rab, because they had a lot of cattle. V'hi ha'isa eretz mikneh, it was a good land for cattle. Abel chatzi shevet Menashe lo haya lo ele v'b'nei gvuraso shel machir shalachad ha'aretz. The reason they got it, Menashe got it, was because Machir was mighty, he conquered that land. V'zu ha'bracha ha'isa lo v'b'nei shaya aviv b'chor Yosef v'hu haya b'chor gamkein. And this blessing of being a great warrior came to him because he was a firstborn son of a firstborn. Remember that we always have this tension in Tanakh, where on the one hand the firstborn is assumed to be greater and stronger than the others, and on the other hand, the firstborn always loses. The firstborn tends to be replaced by a younger sibling, and we've seen repeated examples of that. We don't need to go through that right now. But the point is that one simple explanation for why they're going to get this this land, that being on this northeast corner, is because they conquered it, right of conquest. Right, so that leads to one question of...
I'm strong, so I got it. It's like, well,
right. So why do they want to be there is one question. The other problem, which the Netziv, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, points out in his commentary to the third chapter in Devarim, where this division is also discussed, he says there are loads of cases of conquest in which the Jewish people fought their wars and different people conquered areas and didn't get the land. Why is it that now... specifically, it should go to them. So we have two more suggestions to bring. I'm going to bring one of them, and then the other one we'll just have to wait until after Sukkot when we'll do this in earnest. But take a look at source number 7, Mitzudat David. He says, no. Look at our sentence which identified him as Ish Milchama, a warrior. He says, "Ubachar l'sheves be'ever ha'yarden al hasfar." He chose to dwell on the other side of the Jordan, on the border, b'makom sakana, in danger. Laharos ha'ov de yilulim es giburaso, to display his might to the idolaters. In other words, he wants to intimidate. He says, "We are warriors. We are mighty. We're going to sit on the border in order to forestall any invasions." And so he gets Gilad and Bashan, these lands, in order to deter invaders. He's going to do border patrol. That's a second idea. There's a third idea, but God willing, after Sukkot we will reconvene. I will send out an email in advance to make sure that everybody remembers, but it'll be October 15th, God willing, and we will resume with chapter 17. Thank you very much.